Afternoon, everyone. This is Mary Lee Hall, Senate Commercial Services Committee, will now be to order. It is 3:06 p.m. Thursday, March 5th, 2020, and dinner 3:06. Members present are Representative Cleveland, Representative Spence, Vice Chair, Marissa, Representative Deputy Chair, and Representative Ryan on the line. I am on the line. It's good to hear your voice. The board will reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. If everyone would be concerned, please silence their cell phones for the duration of the meeting. As always, before we begin, I would like to thank Butch Carver, our Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Brad Newell from the Dinner Hall for staffing the committee today. Today, we will be hearing a presentation on how to address some gaps in the crisis with the pediatric response led by Heather Carpenter, Healthcare Policy Advisor at the Department of Health and Social Services, the Chief of the Senate Committee, John Austin Cleary. Then we'll hear House Bill 86 by Representative Fields related to privatization of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And finally, we will hear House Bill 93 offered by Representative Fields related to Staten Ridge's Alaska Psychiatric Institute. I would like to invite Heather Carpenter and Chief Assistant Attorney General Vicki Cleary to come to the presenter's table. If you could please introduce yourself, I recommend making a presentation. I also do want to acknowledge that we have Health and Social Services Deputy Commissioner on the wall and Division of Behavioral Health Director John Fennerell, John Fennerell, that will be present.
Good afternoon, Sam Zulhowski, for the record, I'm Heather Carpenter, Health Care Policy Advisor, Chief Commissioner.
And for the record, I'm our Chair of the Engineering Chairs as the Attorney General of the Department of Law.
Thank you for hearing from us today. As many of you are aware, we had a pretty high visibility case in the last number of years, and that affected us submitting a report to the court on January 21st called Addressing Gaps in the Crisis Psychiatric Response System. We wanted to take a few moments to give you an overview of the case, which was written by A.G. Greeley, and then we'll walk through how the department prepared a response and how we believe we're going to plan to meet the case order.
Thank you, Chair, for the conversation in the Department of Law. As all of you are aware, and have been aware, there's been a long time crisis within the acute psychiatric care in the Anchorage area in particular for the last few years. About a year and a half ago, the Disability Law Center and the Public Defender's Office filed two lawsuits. The Public Defender's Office was a grant for individuals with difficulty hearing and was predicated upon what's called the grant of habeas corpus. And the Disability Law Center filed the lawsuit challenging, seeking injunctive relief so that the department would not be holding individuals in primarily correctional facilities longer than absolutely necessary. Waiting transportation to evaluation and stabilization centers for proper final evaluations. Those two cases were consolidated, and after multi-day hearing and evidence that was taken by Judge Morse, he made a decision in October of 2019, a supplemental decision, granting the relief back to the Disability Law Center and characterized relief sought by the Public Defender's Office as remaining open. He didn't dismiss the case, although habeas corpus petitions were essentially moved because the individuals had already been released from jail, so there wasn't any time there. But the Public Defender's Office adopted what's called interim relief or filed a motion for interim relief, and so there's still an open question before the court as to whether or not some of those claims still remain. He did grant the injunction that was requested by the Disability Law Center, and in his findings articulated that the state must develop a robust plan to meet these gaps in care and to respond to meet the challenges that were occurring that he had identified in his order. That plan, which Heather will, Ms. Carpenter will go through in detail, was submitted a couple of after the court's decision and outlines what the department will do. The parties are, for your information, in active background was going through that line. They may have some other issues with the director or any of the other courses. We can do one in the best data settlement or in those active negotiations right now.
Departments in an almost a 3-page report, if you will need either one for my links to write a full report. I will go over that more convinced to be exactly what I've provided to you as a snapshot. But I want to highlight that as we put together this plan to meet the deadline for us, we worked by and large with stakeholders, including the Toronto State Hospital and Nurse and Health Association as a whole, as well as in particular the two designated outpatient treatment facilities we had at the time, which was the Rosemoral Hospital and Barber Regional Hospital here in Toronto. We also worked with the Department of Corrections and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. When we were having some of those meetings, particularly with Fairbanks and Garland, they really asked us to not break what was working in the Fairbanks region and the Toronto region. And as an example, in Fairbanks, the Fairbanks district is currently not allowing individuals to be held at DNC facilities until they're fully old, which is really not seen as the same issue in the Fairbanks area that we have seen in the New York area. So when the department submitted our plan, it really has an input and self-sufficient focus due to the input of our stakeholders. I also like to bring up just a little pause for a second to identify the terms that I've I'd also like to point out that the plan has an extensive background on how we got to this point, the history of API, the history of our designated evaluation and stabilization centers, and our designated evaluation and treatment centers, as well as the efforts to study this problem and efforts that have been implemented, including the 1115 waiver and the efforts we have in the building before 2016 to address the behavioral health gaps. With that being said, our nominated plan has a stipulation that we will hire a statewide DEP coordinator that would be housed in the commissioner's office. This is to consolidate what is currently happening differently in each social district and done by the Department of Law to track where the active 1047 individuals are, how long they're waiting for beds, and to help connect them to open beds. As a snapshot, just a reminder, those beds can be at the Rockford Psychiatric Institute. And they can also not be at our three DET facilities and Fairbanks Memorial Hospital has 20 beds. When fully running, MATSU will have 16 beds. In June, the Bartlett Regional Hospital has 12 beds. And by consolidating this group, we really feel like it will have a better response to our partners. An individual will be in the commissioner's office, they have just a different relationship with providers. Instead of working with a colleague, they're working with somebody who is more health-focused and very responsive.
So, I have a question. Thank you, Dr. Cheryl Carpenter. I am familiar with designated evaluation and treatment facility, but I'm not familiar with designated evaluation and stabilization term. Can you talk about the distinctions between the two?
So we highlight a hundred so they might be a term of dialogue and the differences in the chair about where we're seeing those models. So there's two different tracking arrangements with providers and there's a designated evaluation and stabilization center at DMS facility. And as a short term facility right now, and Bethel has that designation as does Ketch Canned within the hospital. And so in those circumstances, confidential facilities and getting robust mental health evaluation and evaluating to determine whether or not she meet commitment criteria for a 30-day commitment. But they generally only hold people or keep them in those facilities for up to 7 days. And then the more robust system is the DET, where the evaluation and treatment centers, which are the three that Ms. Carpenter identified, the Bartlett, Fairbanks, and MATSU. And that's where individuals can be committed for up to 30 days. Generally, if you're committed for more than 30 days, those commitments will take place in API.
Thank you.
And as we move to this plan, I will reference the attached submission to fiscal information to be supplied to the committee. And this position was a budget amendment for FY21 that was submitted that would be funded by the Mental Health Trust Authority for its receipts as well as federal funds for our services worker that is dedicated to discharge planning for the hospitals as well as the Department of Corrections. Those of you may be familiar with our EPS workers and working in protecting vulnerable adults. What we have seen is that if an individual is sitting in an ER or Department of Corrections, EPS has had to prioritize other individuals that might be more vulnerable or quote unquote more safe. So we are asking for an individual that will focus on discharge planning from those facilities to help connect people to appropriate placements for longer term care, particularly if we have an individual who might have dementia or other concerns that was maybe denial was filed, but you can't really use in the right place for them. This discharge worker will help find a more appropriate placement. We can also help them with connecting to family members, structured decision makers, or if they see that the guardian is needed, they can help petition the court for a guardian for a vulnerable individual. Again, this was a budget and a request that would be funded by the Mental Health Trust Authority in conjunction with federal funds. As part of the plan, Dr. Nurse really hit home that we needed to identify procedures and mechanisms to evaluate somebody subject to evaluation or who's waited to be admitted to a facility. The code of that also no longer meets evaluation criteria or any transfer to an alternative facility. As you can see, we'll see that individuals are waiting many days either in the ER or in DFC, and he was not sure that they were getting re-evaluated. This was a little bit of a particular pain point for our partner hospitals. However, the department has proposed our method of moving this is that we will use a provider agreement to hire a pool of mental health professionals that can be dispatched to a non-DED facility to re-evaluate individuals who have been waiting 30 hours or 40 hours for admission into a longer-term facility. I will note that our partners at the Department of Corrections are very excited that we will have mechanism to help them out with this need. And this, again, would be funded in partnership with the Mental Health Trust and with $300,000 and $300,000 general funds.
Just a quick clarifying question. The PG noted in your parentheses, is that the grade? On this note, it talks about an agreement for a pool of mental health professionals. Is this more of like a on call? Is that what you're kind of thinking about, like an on call group of people? Because I'm just wondering then what kind of services those individuals might provide when they're not needed for this particular component.
For the chair person, that's exactly what we were envisioning. You know, providers who might be working at a facility or, you know, evaluating elsewhere that, you know, for lack of a better term, might want to do some complaining and have some additional information. The next piece that the government proposed is that we would order the API used by priority rather than biological as it currently is. And we're hoping that would help if somebody is having their first psychotic break, that we can make them quicker and really look at those different items. But again, that would be with clinical factors in mind. The next piece is that judge asked us that we had to pay particular focus to those respondents at Department of Corrections facilities. And we will partner with DOC in creating a process for notification to the Department of Health and Social Services for Title 47 admissions before the court order is issued, so the DES DBT coordinator can assist in finding appropriate evaluation placements outside of DOC and the local jails. We envision that to be a very simple form for our partners at the Department of Corrections, but unless we don't have an automatic mechanism to know if they have somebody sitting in a DOC facility that has that type.
Do you recognize the American Garbs and the
Well, it is our intention to absolutely meet the court's goals that persons who have not been charged with crimes that are suffering from acute psychiatric needs who are sitting in a Department of Corrections facility is waiting for a placement at a DET facility. We cannot guarantee that in all cases. example, sometimes in the Alaska annual hotel, maybe the only safe place to hold somebody until transportation can be made to the head community or into immigrants, parents, et cetera. And finally, with that, if I were to take any legislation that you saw last week, which was HD 33, SB 238, I have involuntary commitment procedures, and one on our psychiatric examination, and insanity for criminal cases, which was HD 304, and that was to help address that process as well.
And can you describe the purpose of the awareness of those people?
That's a very small thing, just really helpful.
Can you describe what HB303 and FB238 seek to create?
Absolutely, and there's a claim that I found a friend for Deputy Commissioner Wall, and I will let him explain all the courses he was taking part on helping to develop those.
So, Deputy Commissioner Wall, can you come forward with the South American?
My name is Robert Wall, I'm Deputy Commissioner for Health and Social Services. The two bills address the two different types of involuntary commitment to psychiatric hospital, one being any psychiatric development that's performed under Title 12 for a criminal procedure, and the other being psychiatric commitment that is done under Title 47 for a civil commitment. There are long time standing issues on both sides of the house concerning who has custody of a patient, what is the procedure for that commitment process. So I'll take each in turn. The first, in Title 12 in the criminal side of the house, there is a department of statute that the evaluation be performed by two certified, forensic certified psychologists. That's a historical definition. In Everdale, but there's a lot of that statute in the state. They're very difficult to find. There's about 375 certified forensic psychologists in the entire nation. They're extremely expensive. There are not in the state of Washington. So the effort is being made to make that statute read more on average than the rest of the states do for that particular process, rather than what is currently stated. So that's kind of the bulk of what's being done on the clinical side.
I'm sorry, Simon?
I'm standard both psychiatrists or psychologists. There's not only a psychologist on the clinical. There's the ability to do that, correct? If I may clarify, the statute reads that the psychiatrist has to be qualified as well. And what happens is even psychiatrists that work at IDPI or another PT. Many not feel qualified in the area of forensics specifically, and some they disqualify themselves. They're also difficult to find.
Forensic psychiatrists, even a smaller population, that 400 or larger forensic psychologists is in the national population of forensic psychiatrists down in the Pacific Range.
So, I'm kind of pleased with the territory. It's a very small group of people. There are people that are at the same size as each other. Very highly trained and because of that, very expensive. Those evaluations can be done by the type of psychiatrists and psychologists that don't have to meet the full forensics capacity. So that's the middle of this criminal involuntary process. It deals with the civil involuntary process, really, is talking a great deal about who has custody of a patient or not. There has been some, unclear practice in the past in the state as to when the Department of Health and Social Services custody of a patient starts in the evaluation process, and it clarifies it will be at the time that the evaluation takes place. And for transport as well, it also clarifies that DT should have a full 72 hours for the evaluation process to occur. And the reason why moving towards that is because often it's not a chance of doing a time for a patient in crisis to stabilize enough for the actual evaluation to even be an effective evaluation. And there's different kinds of recreation. It's some kind of being kind of get that they're able to make the evaluation to make sense. So they need that extra time, the whole length of time, the lines of place, and the ability to make that evaluation.
Department of EBA said we needed to have, for the record, the coordinator, the football team manager, department recognized that in order to fully implement this plan, we needed to have several pieces that we would continue to do. And one of those was continuing to move forward with our partners, in particular our hospital partners, and then we would continue to implement to our entire payroll system that we will engage with hospitals as well as our other frontline behavioral health providers on best practices, making sure we have promise and advisory available. One of the big things that the hospital asked us to please make sure we do is connect EPA to the editing system or the emergency department information exchange. And that will help somebody who may have been in APA recently to make sure that they are for those doctors to be able to pull their medication information when they're treating that individual. And that we will continue to support a full continuum of care, including any long-term chronic stabilization. So we are committed to continuing to be our partners and work with them. And we're going to extend the list of those items listed on page 21 and 22 of the plan. As part of this, we also recommended two changes to the electric court system survey court forms.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for interrupting the Chair. But I want to send you one here. One of the issues that has been brought to my office repeatedly has to do with grievances. And there's some folks that you may have interacted with, big players in North Collins and they tend to keep in mind. When you talk about some of these best practices, do you think that that would include discussion on some of the grievance procedures and how to improve that process?
Through the chair, Representative Tyler, absolutely. And you know, we still have to move that between the folks in the room today. And you would see that we'll be a group effort and absolutely something we can have in the PR team look at against grievances for advocacy. And we would be happy to talk with our actual providers and see if that's something in. You know, around behavioral health treatment that we need the systems on their grievance procedures. So yes, we would be very committed to looking at that.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I really appreciate the offer.
As I was saying, we recommended a couple of different changes to the court system on our forms. One of them was to modify the treatment reputation of right forms into one form, and this was a form that the DES DET coordinator could encourage all of our partners to use. We also asked them to change the form that is about ordering an individual to be treated or placed at API or a DET facility. Right now, the judge has the discretion to name which facility that person can go to, and you see that that's included in our options when we are trying to place patients quickly in an available bed. At the same time, we're asking the judge to make that more generic so that the DET coordinator can help find somebody at the most appropriate placement first, but that would be working with our partners. Often if somebody is in Fairbanks or in Trudeau Community State regionally, and those providers may want to treat those regional patients first. So just because you're asking for that change would mean we would be forcing a decision on one of our partners.
Is there a step back to item 1A about the partnership work that the department is doing. You had mentioned that there are various EPI, but that there are also DET facilities like Burbank Family Finance, who DES, which is slightly less smaller time frames than areas like Buffalo, Michigan. Can you talk a little bit about, so it sounds like, in part, I want to make sure that I understand this, the DET facilities in Burbank, Fairbanks, and Matsu are able to have a patient within their priority for up to 30 days?
terms of asking around some of the findings and as they take those finding evidence and as a long-term patient, that they may have most likely not found that patient's PPI. Can we talk a little bit about how the discharge process works with patients that may be coming in from other parts of the state and after an extended stay, whether at API or one of those other facilities, how is the coordination and discharge handled? Are those individuals just kind of left discharged out on their own volition, or is that in partnership with maybe institutions? I'm thinking particularly for individuals that are coming in from other parts of the state, but maybe that's not their own community. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, cheers, all things to you. So if somebody is out of Title 47 and is admitted to one of these DEP facilities, the department will make sure that that individual is transferred to the HSP home. We have a DEP transportation guard line, as well as our Medicaid options. And that really relates to a lot of the out-of-region residents. They had a request for 300 out-of-region admissions in the last year to their mental health unit, and the lawyer shared information on how they work with discharge planning. They will even send somebody, a companion who is a hospital staff member, with an individual on a plane and be sending grids to make sure somebody who is discharging them gets on a final plane to their own community. They will work with the social worker at Berkeley, will work and spend a lot of time with the patients to find out what they need upon discharge, and they will set up items really provided by the community to make sure discharge is successful. Jumping out of longer, these items that are DEP facilities take on there are conversations with them. They have shared these burdens, but there is often not compensation for that. So as part of this plan, in funding it, we have proposed the SMDT initiative grant to cover some of that, given that they've been compensated by the daily revenue either through Medicaid or our DEP dish payments. And that would be at discharge planning. It might be when they're spending time filing daily updates with the court system, like in their banks. And so we've actually proposed $125,000 for each DES facility and $250,000 for each DET facility. That's so that was a $1 million, and that's online, and that's on the spreadsheet that you gave you. And we also have a contingency bond money request of $375,000 that can finalize an additional DES and DET provider to sign up.
So then the example that you provided with Bartlett, was that done at that facility's expense, or was that done through financial collaboration with the state?
The financial collaboration would be around the transportation piece, and the transportation piece for the patient would be handled by the Division of Behavioral Health, and Director Laura Johnson is here if you have specific questions on how that funding works. But the rest of that discharge funding really is at the expense of the individual providers.
Percent of all residents that are discharged from a facility that doesn't reside in that facility. If you can provide my office with some information, I'd be curious to see how many, I guess, what the type of need is for wraparound services for residents that maybe I have fractional mental state from discharging them out of the facility in a community that's not their own community. I'd just be interested to know more data.
We have facilities in so many communities, so I would say that you're doing a lot of out-of-region placements. And I will work with our DEP providers to get more information and they can provide us on their experiences as well.
Great, thank you.
So continuing on, we also have that in the plan of having them into a partnership with the implementation of the crisis now model. I was fortunate enough to go with a mental health trust down to Arizona in December to look at that model. Deputy Commissioner Wall and other members of the department have been there as well, and we've had different touch points with the crisis now model. As you were probably aware, our international data report that was funded through the Mental Health Trust Authority. And the good news of the is broken, consumer confidence, mobile crisis team, and crisis stabilization. And then the partner, when we talk about it globally, also having a full continuum of care. Three of those are already supported and have funding mechanisms through the local 15 million model of labor. And Director Rudy has done a great job of making sure that we have a really good funding mechanism to fund the bulk of those services. And the next item, the LPP, is successfully implementing the local 15 member. And if this committee has heard of many, many updates on the local 15 waivers, so I will just kind of gloss over that because I know you're a lot familiar with it. The appointment of members that in order to successfully implement this plan, we needed to have several legislative and law appropriation and other requests. I walked through some of those already, but I will highlight the additional ones that I did not hit. We also ask for money through a forfeited claims line in the supplemental budget for crisis placement provider agreements. And this would also be funded, this is $128,000 of UTF, and it would be funded with Medicaid receipts as well. So this would be for placements of individuals with some psychiatric needs that API might not be, or our IT facilities might not be the best place there for them. And we're really looking at those individuals who may have complex medical needs as well as behavioral health needs. So API is just not set up to deal with somebody who has a trachea, for example, on top of their other crazy psychiatric needs. I did say a little bit about the grants that we did have for those grants to incentivize and help ease the burden on our DES and DED partners. The next big item that the department has asked for is disproportionate share of hospital funding. That would be $4.5 million that UGF matched with $4.5 million federal funding. As you are probably not aware, in 2018, there was a 2-year appropriation of action funds of $14 million to have a 2-year project for this to expand that services. But I just want to highlight a couple of those projects and how it's coming to the point. And you know, it sees that this is really the engine of one mechanism to have stability in our crisis effective response. So, unless the region was able to get $2 million over the 2 years, the substance abuse treatment provider, that was their category of DISH funding. And we were qualified because of their contract with the MyHealth clinic that allows the referral hospital to refer patients to the clinic for outpatient substance abuse treatment. The DISH funding received is critical to keeping that clinic open. And if the DISH funding ended at the end of this fiscal year, they would have to analyze the new services to determine which ones were beneficial to the MCDO. Some of those included a social worker who was dedicated to the emergency department. And without that funding, that social work position would likely have to be shifted to assisting with discharge planning for Medicaid patients with lower health sustaining. Telepsychiatry has been implemented in the Planners here to complement their telehealth program. They now pay for behavioral health physician coverage through their hospitalist group. They have set up a behavioral emergency response team with this money as well, and they've had additional security rounds. This really feeds into the whole continuum, so that was just one example of what the last year regional has been able to do, and how even though DISH funding is for uncompensated care, all payers have really benefited from those additional positions. One other example is Hermes Memorial Hospital received $2.2 million to set up a single point of entry psychiatric emergency room. And Hermes has been one of our DED providers for 20 years. And those funds that they got through the single point of entry allowed them to improve their quality of care at the emergency room for patients who are seeking out the behavioral and mental health services. So FMH and Room to Deals has hired additional professional staff, including social workers, security officers, psychiatrists, and legal assistants. And they really sought after this with their years of work with the North Social District. And again, you know, as I said earlier, that the judges at the judges did not allow individuals to be called in DOC. And I just want to give a big kudos to Florida Memorial Hospital and Foundation Health Partners for stepping up and filling the need in the behavioral health continuum there. Medicare ED. And that does make that continuum services. There is a contract that every provider who receives this test is contracted with the Department of Health, Division of Behavioral Health. And the contract with the Memorial Hospital requires at least 500 encounters of patients annually. In calendar year 2018, FMA experienced 1,619 encounters in their sample of entry. And in calendar year 2019, they had 1,635 encounters, and tripling the requirement of their contract. And the last little piece was increasing our TED secure transport by $500,000. And again, that goes back to your question, shareable copy, making sure we have the resources to get individual to match their home community. So that is the broad structure of the plan, and I'm happy to answer any follow-up questions.
Can you provide the numbers again for how many beds are available at Bartlett, Lazio, and Vierings, and then at the DES facilities as well?
Honestly, I do not have the beds for the DES facility at the moment, and I will follow up with that information. So Vierings Memorial Hospital has 20 beds. Bartlett Regional Hospital has 12. And the Lazio Hospital just opened there.
We are going to take a brief recess. Right, we are back on record, and we will now be joining our attention task by using my representative fields. I understand that there's a committee of subs just with your introduction. Carol Zolkowski, I'm with the House Health and Social Services Committee about the blend of any substitute for HPE includes work order number 31-LS0623-U as a working document. I will object for the purposes of discussion, Representative Fields, and the CEO and staff to Representative Fields, if you could introduce yourselves for the record and walk us through the bill and the changes in the CS.
I'm Carol Zolkowski, Representative Fields. I'm the recommended executive and staff attorney for the Executive Fields. Thank you again for the opportunity to do a second hearing on House Bill 86. Hopefully, there's backlog for you because we went through some of this last year and didn't get the opportunity to see the committee substitute if that's the case. What about grant on API? I think the bottom line here is we have far fewer beds than we need and far fewer beds than have been available historically. Again, more background. We don't have enough beds to meet present need, and it creates myriad problems ranging from people with psychiatric issues to receiving treatment, which puts asthma at risk. The other issue that creates beyond API is that when the beds are in API, hospitals have to hold some patients in the emergency room very widely. Which is expensive for hospitals, and this cost gets passed on to private insurance plans, which drives up the cost of healthcare, and it's not safe for other people in the ER. There's going to be a lot of discussion about this over the last year, and I think it's just worth noting that there's been a lot of efforts around attempted privatization of API since this bill was introduced. Following the lawsuit, the state is not currently privatizing API, while PATH continues to have a short duration contract to provide some management services. I would say that the size of that contract has gone down, and what House Bill 86 would do is prevent overall privatization. patient of the entire facility. The Medicare Institute does not prohibit prioritization of certain functions within API. All our background on Baltimore's corporate history, there are a lot of really troubling examples of negligent care at Baltimore facilities around the country. And Corrective Solutions, which is one of the companies that is part of Baltimore, has been sued about 1,400 times since 2003. And there have been numerous substantiated claims of wrongful death. And some of them are really more fun when you read about them. And if they show in practice what were the suspected theory, even though when you have a private home facility, you don't have a facility that tends to maximize profit. And one of the ways that you maximize profit is by having adequate staffing, adequate compensation for staffing, adequate training for staffing. That puts both patients and employees at risk. Fundamentally, a facility like API has a public function, and is that compatible with a for-profit mission? A little more detail on the timeline behind WellPath and API. Over the last 30 plus years, Correctional Medical Group, Wagon Hut Corrections Corporation, have merged Durbin Correct Care Solutions. DO Group has been involved with this company. And shortly after the gubernatorial election, Correctional Correct Care Solutions rebranded itself as WellPath. And there was a meeting thereafter that announced the sole source memory contract to allow WellPath, formerly Correct Care Solutions, to take over API. Of course, that permanent Salesforce maybe privatization was located, which forced the department to back off during privatization, not stating that WellPath the case of a role at the facility today. I think it's worth noting in the history that I turnover of numerous positions at the WellPath. We've heard from staff who were concerned about WellPath's management, and there have been numerous reports, including in the media, where watchdogs have criticized WellPath's failure to bring conditions at API where they need to be. Again, just a little more background on some of WellPath/CorrectCare's history. From Florida to California to other states. It's also worth noting that the legislature has looked at API management before and examined a wide range of options for managing the facility, ranging from wholesale privatization to partial privatization to modified state management. And there was a recent comprehensive website from 2017 that the full privatization entails decreased quality services and higher costs. And the same legislative study recommended state management with consideration of outsourcing what they considered non-core services. So, pretty much the state proposal 86. And it's consistent with this legislative study, which ensures broad management with opportunities to outsource certain functions, but not management of the whole facility. Again, there's been a lot of public engagement on this, and just wanted to send the public support for continued public management of API. And I also want to note that the Sun Consulting Group has looked at private operations of sites such as this, and when they are privately managed for profit, it costs a significant amount of extra money in terms of profit margin on top of basic operations in the facility. And finally, the profit motive is incompatible with the basic mission of API because it creates an ongoing incentive for the private owner to provide adequate staffing to meet patients and employees' needs. In conclusion, the committee sets a target at before you. This subject's a terminology, and it does allow for prioritization of certain functions, but not of the entire facility. And I think this is a good balance to ensure that
Thank you. Thank you.
authorized staff to report. And in the last year, since we've had this new business over and the average people have had, it's been there. If you would argue that maybe it was training of staff, well, since then we have seen that staff support is they've got de-escalation training coming from Canada. We've got various types of training in the last 3 months. For support rehabilitative and psychological department and credentialing and all that. They've had a lot of these things happen in the last year. And so I guess what I need to understand is if it's funding, I guess it's one conversation, but if it's who is managing it, if it's an additional training since in the last year with WellPath being there, that, and we have lots of sexual assaults take place, that it was, like I said, it was not due to lack of personnel, it was due to failure by the staff to report. So help me understand that, based on your testimony, how that correlates with
Thank you.
situation where the parties kind of being on the standards for the people in the case. We have a constitutional right to preservation to provide that type of information to people. So I hope that answers your question.
Spring of 2018 was tired of the unfortunate sexual assaults. And I also highlight that, of course, at the beginning of this year or last year, under state management, was when CMS was going to actually take their license. That's been restored since then. Happened at our capacity by 80%. We've recruited hiring psychiatric providers. And just my point here is that even when we did additional funding, it was after that that we saw the sexual assault. We saw the failure in management and of course, leading up to last year, being the place where they were back to the CMS license. And once we jumped out someone in, that we got ourselves at a point where we did not. I guess if the issue that someone else with WellPath, let's be, then the CEO brought up WellPath. If the issue is with someone right now, who I can show is that they've actually successfully increased operating and kept the license, if the issue was with privatization, I think it's just going to say, well, they don't just don't like privatization, but someone has to make the argument that privatization itself has failed. And I think at this point, with the increased capacity, with the fact that we've I'm still trying to allow for the case to be made for this bill. Even in your argument, the funding aspect of things did not prevent the sexual assaults while it was under state full of police management.
Record. They're people are not being there, they're under no tax leadership.
This contract was awarded in October, and I would
been asked for some additional information which we provided to them when we granted the exception to long-term.
I'm curious as to what the department was seeking to understand or learn. I mean, it's very reasonable to do a vision study. I'm looking at right at the 98-page report that was done in 2017. What is it? What are the new insights that could possibly have
looking at this and asking them four options. It's not strictly looking at prioritization. It's looking at what is the best mechanism to run the hospital. So that's what this thing will do in the market, just a typical proposition study.
My understanding is that there's not a lot of states that are doing this, and that we could potentially be sort of blazing trail in an area that isn't done a lot of work, kind of like public safety.
Yes, I pointed out that the direction of all the same is
the paper shows could be a bad way or something like that.
I do want to thank Mr. Eckhoff for your
in the urbanized field, and so do you want to walk us through the signal and the changes in SES?
So the carrier needs to go to the signal.
Changes explained in the walkthrough with the CS and going to the objection to adopting the CS today. Is there any further objection to adopting the committee substitute? Hearing one, the committee substitute has been adopted as a working document. Thank you, representative. At this time, we will hold this bill over. We will now turn our attention to House Bill 183 by Representative Fields. I understand that also a committee substitute for introduction. Chairman Wilkins and members of the Health and Social Services Committee about the blank committee substitute for HB 183, work order number 31-OS-1211-5 as a working document. I will objection and prepare the discussion. Representative Fields and Ms. Nicotto, if you could go ahead and just introduce yourselves for the record and begin the walkthrough.
For the record, again, my name is Beth Fields, and I'm staff to Representative Zach Fields.
Zach Fields, and I encourage, thanks again to Chair Zulkowski for hearing a couple bills on API. I think it's been also a complimentary House Bill 183 that addresses staffing and capacity issues, which are very necessary to address in order to provide good safe conditions at API and address the need in the community for both. Public safety and for a more cost-effective healthcare system. So, House Bill 183 would expand capacity at API by addressing health retention, by correcting wage disparities that currently exist in the private sector, and improving labor capacity by establishing a prevailing wage institution to ensure the staff are getting paid properly to some of our occupations elsewhere in the community. That's about being approved by the recruitment in our region. The bundle also sets a floor for maintaining bed count. I think it's fairly low floor, but perhaps a necessary one. That's on the low counts that we've continued to see over the last couple of years. Finally, the bed requires DHSS to prepare an annual report produced early to the bill, including staffing standards. So, with that, we go to start bed counts. And again, as we discussed in the previous bill, even the beds would be lower than we've had several decades ago. And I think it's worth noting that back before bed counts, the facility is almost full most of the time. As you know, bed count in the adolescent unit is zero. That's a good problem for public safety. That's a problem for the community and for adolescents who need sick treatment. And I think community members are all aware that ABI is one of several facilities that provides psychiatric treatment, including Providence and South Central and other facilities elsewhere in the state. One of the things that I've heard over and over from healthcare providers is how expensive and dangerous it is when a lack of capacity at ABI forces hospitals to hold psychiatric patients in an emergency room, often for days, if not weeks. And when that happens, those type patients require one-on-one guards. This is not safe for medical providers at our hospitals. It's not safe for admins who are going to the ER for very different issues. And those costs get paid and passed on directly to private health insurance payers, including the state of Alaska itself. My understanding is that, first of all, the way that reimbursement works, providers are not able to bill for all these costs now, but the administration is actually changing reimbursement so that even more costs will get passed on to providers. And again, in terms of those costs, will get passed on to private payers. The state of Alaska is the private payer, about a quarter of the budget in Alaska's private payer. So when we create these, when we create situations where we have significant uncompensated care, those costs do get passed directly back to the state itself, which puts upward pressure on premium growth, premium cost growth, which in turn makes it harder for us to find sustainable fiscal solutions. So, my ER holds it. Property hospitals like Providence and Regional are a big problem in terms of both public safety and our state's broader fiscal picture. If we're moving on ER holds for site patients as a result of inadequate capacity in API, are not only a problem for South Central, they're a problem in Southeast and the interior as well. And then, there's a previous bill because it talks some about how staffing issues and management are closely related. And just want to highlight how adequate capacity and staffing is essential for safe workplaces. In 2010, there was a really horrific story about the site nurse assistant at the API that was assaulted and unfortunately was staff or whatever. As Jake Metcalf said, that when they're on staff and patients are often placed in dangerous situations where there's a dangerous situation, patients don't have medical supervision, including they're being transported to different places in a hospital. The State Department never recognized this when they issued a very harsh fine. Unfortunately, it's a pretty firm fine. Episodes of violence at API, again, before we use any type of staffing. Unfortunately, the problems of violence have grown as inadequate staffing has continued. You know, what I've heard from the administration with respect to OPEC's performance on addressing staffing issues is there's a big disconnect with what I've heard from employees. They're saying that they're short staffed right now, and they're coverage burdens from them with the PUC. What is disparities between providers at API and comparable health facilities? I know it's worth noting, every time I talk to an employee at API, they work at a facility because they really believe in the facility's mission. I mean, it's a big sacrifice to work at API. It's a better place to work. It's a better place to work. And I think we should applaud the employees who perform public service by working there. And really, the least we can do is make sure they're compensated at a comparable level to other facilities, but frankly, they're going to be safer and happier to do that. HB 183, I think the deal of staffing and capacity issues is consistent with the 2019 comprehensive report, the 2017 prioritization feasibility study. And like I said, I'm just going to previous legislatures have attempted to address some of these staffing issues, but as I think they have noted, over the years adopted and said, sufficient to meet the realities of API. That concludes the summary. That's the 23. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the legislation. I'm just wondering a little bit more about the prevailing rate of wages for federal work. And so I'm just wondering, is that defined so that employees of North Star will be the comparable facilities? Because it's our whole real estate rate facility. So, and for the prevailing wages, just the interaction of how that structure would work, and is there any potential that would limit the union's ability to negotiate something that was better than that then? Or is it setting the, I guess it's the not less than, so we would limit them, but you could just throw a little more of that.
Sure, pretty fair. It would be a good policy, so it's not a prevailing wage, in the sector that is slowly, however. State prevailing wages are nothing new. That prevailing wage has been structured for a long time. And you are correct that the not less than language ensures that the prevailing wage floor, because it is a floor, is consistent with collective bargaining agreements. And if the state and division unions wanted to set wages higher than the prevailing wage for comparable positions, perhaps because the UDI is a really challenging place to work, that would be in the state's and the union's prerogative. You also asked about comparable occupations, and again, the prevailing wage language in the bill is based on other prevailing wage processes and things done for other sectors, and they actually look at labor gains at specific occupations. And my understanding and my intention is that given that a lot of those occupations exist beyond API and OSR, could be a real prevailing wage in a market where finance is a big employer, regional is a big employer, you have division of people, justice, you have correctional employees who have similar jobs. It would really be important to look at the prevailing wages in the broader market, recognizing that it's not just North Star and API.
Thank you.
Ms.
Boyle, we'd like to
So, if you're certain to have more patients, need to be 380 yeah, rather than support grant facilities.
Well, I think that we want to make sure that our staffing ratios at APR are appropriate and we're not forcing ourselves to have slots open that we don't have the capacity to staff. Because I mean, that's the problem for you. That is less than today, right? We don't have that staffing for the patients that are on site, but also, we don't really strongly that we need to have APR functioning at its full capacity. We, as we started earlier in the presentation, we used to have 960 inpatient beds at APR, and it's true that our hospitals across the state don't have the capacity to be difficult, acute inpatient behavioral health need to take you now, but I don't think that with our population growth, we can really justify having our facility be operating at anything really less than its full capacity. And so, I'm interested in potentially working with you as a sponsor to increase that number so that we're making sure we're meeting the need of the state house.
I mean, I would be supportive that and defer those to the committee by the right number, whether it's either or less. And, naturally, as I mentioned earlier, the department sometimes the answer to that don't represent our responsibility. The department doesn't even pay program wages with conflict with collective bargaining agreements. And with the unions that represent the employees, ASU, APA have told me that that is not their view. And we also judge a question from the video, and they said that the sound of saying program wages are agreement before does not conflict with collective bargaining agreements as you're proposing that clarification.
I just have to comment, but I just think it's interesting on the heels of the earlier conversation and the disability and health side of the lawsuit and all of the costs associated with this, that if you think we can't afford some things, right, it becomes a lot more expensive when we don't do it right the first time. And I know there have been a number of lawsuits and other things that API has bought, so I just think this is one of those times to think about not being sort of penny-wise and pound-foolish. It's just this is a fix for if you don't have adequate staffing and have a high functioning facility, then I think it's incredible. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, really conceptual. Thank you.
All right, for the parent. Section 1. This section runs BS 18.05.020, the statute governing the annual report to the legislature, specifically requires them to report employee attrition and departures, vacancies, recruitment and retention, and additional funding and personnel needs required for operation. Section 2. The section runs AS23.10.045B, the statute regarding employee compensation rate, with conforming language that reflects Section 3 of this bill. The CS for HB183 has been corrected to read hospital employees working out of the bill. State healthcare provider. Section 3. The section amends PLs 47.30.660 to increase and maintain bed caps, implement staffing standards, and establish wages as determined by the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Section 4. This section defines the applicability of this bill to contracts entered into amended, extended, or renewed on or after the effective date of this grace.
Any additional questions for the committee at this time? All right. Thank you for speaking to the bill as well as walking us through the section related to the CS. I'm going to move my objection to adopt the document as a working document. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, the CS has been adopted as a working document. We will now turn to invite Doug Tony. We will begin with Mike Reagan for the disability last time we left there on the line. We do hear you, Mr. Reagan, if you can by introducing yourself, you're not going to begin your testimony.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Mark Regan. I'm the legal director of the Disability Law Center of Alaska. We have a number of roles and things that you heard today. We are the PS
Thank you.
being evaluated as much as happened immediately, basically, under the law of injury. That doesn't make people be second this way. This is not a problem that started in the fall of 2018. This has been happening sporadically for many years. But in the fall of 2018, it got a whole lot worse. And this is one step towards government does need to act and getting the system to operate the way it should so that people do not have to sit in a hospital or a visiting room with staff very, it's friendlier and happier in a hospital being in a unit or visiting room than it is in jail. But in either place, you have to sit and wait for the same old hospital to evaluate you. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Can I have this coming in? We have simply run out of time. It looks like there were a couple of other, a few other individuals who made up for it. That's why we will return to that testimony on House Bill 183 next week. We will be holding it over at this time. The next meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee will be meeting on Monday. I do want to just underscore that that's a day change. Monday, March 9th at 3 p.m. here in Davidson, 106. We will be hearing testimony from Rob Olmert, chairman of the Committee on Action on Toxics, the effects of PFOA and PFOS-related contamination. Again, we will also be returning to House Bill 186 and House Bill 183 with both invited and public testimony on Tuesday, March 9th on our during our regular committee time. The deadline for submitting amendments to my office for both of those pieces of legislation will be Monday, March 8th at 5 p.m. The time is 4:57 p.m. and this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.